Kia ora and welcome to another podcast in our series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. In fact, it's one of the very last podcasts of the whole series, and it's one where I actually have the privilege of introducing you to a panel of five climate-savvy local citizens in the Nelson-Tasman region commenting particularly on our local situation here. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of other ways you can listen, but now let's listen to our panel of five. Well, in this episode of the People, Places and the Climate Crisis series, we have a different and very special event. We have a wonderful and diverse climate-savvy panel who've engaged with the series and will give us their take on what they've heard. And I'm sitting with bated breath, dying to hear their different views. In this order, we'll be hearing from Peter Ollerenshaw, Yachal Opson, Jack Santa Barbara and Barb Robson. And I'll tell you a little more about each one when it's their turn to speak. Unfortunately, Astrid Sayer is down with a strep throat and won't be able to join us, at least not in this session, but I do hope to record her feedback a little bit later on. I also want to explain how the session will run. In the first of two phases, each of our five guests will have up to 4 minutes to share their views on what they've heard on the podcast series. Plus, if they wish to comment on mayoral candidates that didn't front up on our show, that is also in order. That's the session that will be broadcast on Fresh FM, but on the Resilience podcast, that will be expanded by a freewheeling follow-up discussion between the panelists on what they've heard from each other or on other related matters. So it's time to give the microphone to our first guest. It's lovely to be able to kick off this session with Peter Ollerenshaw. Peter is both an environmental architect with a passion for lowering the carbon footprint of our buildings and a transport specialist who convenes NELSUST, the leading sustainable transport group in the Nelson-Tasman region. A warm welcome, Peter. I'm so looking forward to hearing your views, and thanks for being first off the starting block.
Good evening, Lindsay. Good to be here. So it was interesting that Nick Smith and Tim Skinner declined to answer your questions, to join you in the podcast. I think it speaks volumes about their refusal to participate. Perhaps they didn't want to answer the questions posed. And I don't really think Kerry Neal needs any discussion. The others, though, interesting, Ali Cook, who was all about individual responsibility, which I think that can be taken too far. Sure, people need to take some responsibility for their actions, but a lot of things are bigger than individuals. She was keen on solar without realising the daily and seasonal divergence between use and generation. She talked about cleaning out ditches, you know, as being really important, whereas, you know, really there's bigger things than that. Talked about freight shifting and how there's no alternatives to fossil fuels at the moment without really realizing about mode shift, you know, putting freight on coastal shipping to lower emissions or on rail. Mike Harvey, an appalling standpoint, really, that suggesting we should stop thinking about global issues. Couldn't understand that. Loves growth. He's a capitalist, but wants serious green solutions. Hates working in groups. Yeah, and unconvincing. He was all about plastic going to the oceans. That were a major thing for him. Tidying up the stormwater. So really, I think he had very little idea of the most important issues. Richard Ormiston was fascinating, as always. He's a very bright cookie. I'm not sure about the money-free society curing all ills. His spaceship Earth notion is really worth thinking about further, that things that you wouldn't do on a spaceship because it doesn't make any sense, that's the sort of thing we should be thinking about not doing on Earth because it doesn't make any sense. We're a spaceship. Tim King was surprisingly switched on. And I think he's what Jess Berenson Shaw would say, a surprising person to front of view. he was surprisingly switched on about energy reduction and things that we need. But coming from a farming background, you know, wearing cowboy boots, most a lot of people would listen to him where they wouldn't listen to the likes of James Shaw. Matt Lowry was an absolute step change. Step change above everyone else in terms of knowledge of the real issues and great solutions. Rohan, like Matt, was again a step change beyond the other candidates, but a lovely vision of the Mai Tai. Complete opposite of Ali Cook, thinking about individual responsibility, whereas he was thinking about community. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter. That's great. So, and you've given a really great overview. Now I'm delighted to introduce Yechiel Upson, a catalyst, a connector, and mechanical engineer. Yechiel leads social enterprise Novology, supporting clients to develop climate resilient strategies and disruptive products, such as what professors at University of California, Berkeley called the world's healthiest desk. Wow, that's great. He draws on intersectoral experience spanning transport, environment, and technology. Welcome, Yechiel. I'm really looking forward to hearing your input.
Many thanks for having me, Lindsay. I think lying before us is perhaps the biggest shot at cultural maturity ever presented to mankind. It's as if the 2000s millennia is like preparing to interview for that dream job as a global civilization. And despite spending the noughties in denial and the teens in anger and bargaining and COVID in depression, I can see the evidence of growing acceptance, enough to fuel a deep hope that we can manifest this into meaning and direct action, if not for our generation, for our grandkids. It is already time to imagine our future beyond decarbonisation. It's a theme I heard through these talks, and as Nick Agar puts it, to do so boldly as a form of insurance against uncertainty. I say, yep, let's take our host's approach of a yes if, rather than a no because attitude, and explore the options to hand. To be clear, Lindsay, we do have ourselves a crisis, an intense time of difficulty or danger, but it's one in which we can all play our part. Series guest Dr. Joanna Santa Barbara put it beautifully in saying that we're part of a relay marathon across generations. Some of the greatest challenges include our own psychology, culture, and narratives. We find it hard to deal with non-linear concepts like our exponential growth and consumption of energy and resources, or the tipping points scientists are warning about in our natural systems. There are some members in our communities who can see around the corner, the intuitives and systems thinkers, people with minds that join the dots. Our series guest, Professor Pat Bodger, noted that everything we buy or do consumes energy and gives rise to emissions. If we don't do something, we don't use energy or create emissions. And that's a neat switch. It's somewhere I suggest we begin. Messages I might address to our incoming counsellors, you know, primarily stop treating things in isolation. a great example of this is the current road speed strategy throughout our regions, with a very close focus on road user safety, and even more narrowly within that, on the safety of impact. But we ignore the opportunity to merge that with all of the other factors involved, including road pollution, environment, more livable cities, and so forth. Start cross-training your staff now. The last couple of decades hasn't been good reference material for the world that we're moving into going forwards. Meeting the magnitude and urgency of the climate crisis means, while maintaining climate calm, is, as one contributor puts it, will require some more strategic support of our community. This demands better delegated authority within our government structures, but moreover, actively in seeking enablement of community innovation. Yeah, thank you.
Many thanks, Yechiel. It's now my great pleasure to introduce Jack Santa Barbara. Jack is a retired CEO with wide involvement in climate issues, such as being a director of Zero Carbon Nelson Tasman and a regular contributor for Newsroom. Jack also has a particular passion for energy issues and is a strong critic of shortcomings in government policy in the renewable energy transition. A very big welcome, Jack, and let's hear what you have to say.
Hi, Lindsay. Thanks for the opportunity. One of the things that really struck me in listening to the candidates' response to your questions was how difficult it is for candidates to actually formulate a useful strategy for climate change, because we have a community that is very divided and or just doesn't know what the magnitude of the problem is, for one thing, and how quickly things are changing and the actual existential risks that we're facing. It's very difficult, I think, for politicians to talk about these things because they're not popular. You know, and I tried to think, well, what would I want to hear from candidates indicating that they really understood the climate issue and how it relates to the even broader environmental problems that we have? And what would I like to hear them say about what they were going to do? And I realized that if I heard that from a candidate, that candidate would probably not be able to be elected. So that's one of the dilemmas we face. And it struck me as I listened to the candidates' responses to your questions, was that many of them had good ideas, but none of them had a comprehensive plan. You know, I mean, sure, we need more active transport and public transport, and several of the candidates talked about that. There were only a couple that talked about the need to actually reduce energy demand. And I think that was very, very telling. And I think it was both Rohan and Tim King that did that. And, you know, I guess if I were running, for example, you know, I might identify those sort of issues, because it could lead to more policies and actions that could actually get reduction in energy demand, you know, without having to talk about things like energy descent, which none of the candidates gave any indication of being conscious of. So it was interesting too that Tim King talked about the problem of polarization. You know, he was addressing this, you know, that as mayor, he's already had to deal with, you know, multiple interest groups. I mean, that's part of what politics is about, isn't it? It's trying to balance the interest groups. But I was very disappointed in his response to how to deal with it. The idea was to compromise, you know, rather than go with the science, which was, again, a very political. So it says as much about the political system that we're dealing with as it does about the candidates. And I think that's important for us to keep that in mind, because it tells us what we as the public need to be doing. And that reminds me of another omission, that none of them mentioned the Nelson-Tasman Climate Forum, you know, which James Straw, for example, identified as one of the jewels of the climate movement in New Zealand. And so, you know, there is a model of trying to involve people and getting these good ideas and sorting them through in implementation. So I hope that, you know, whoever becomes mayor will reach out to the community and realize that politicians are not going to do this. You know, it's got to be the community. Yes. And none of them, for example, talked about a citizens' assembly as a way of trying to bring together the various issues and interest groups to actually come together and nut it out, you know, with good facilitation. Having said all of that, I think there was also someone else mentioned Rohan's had a vision. And I think that was great, because none of the other ones actually presented a vision. I could quibble with his vision, but at least he was thinking about a vision and hope presumably would be open to elaborations and modifications of it. And so to me, he would be a desirable candidate for Nelson and for Tasman. I don't see the need to replace Tim. You know, while there's additional things he might be doing, I don't see anybody who's going to do anything more than he already is. Thanks.
Thanks,
Jack, that's another complimentary perspective, because you've got into the question of process quite a bit there, and that's wonderful. It's now a real pleasure to welcome Barb Robson to the show. Barb has had a multifaceted engagement with climate issues, ranging from climate justice to active transport to cultural and spiritual aspects of climate initiatives. She also brings an impressive track record in that oh-so-important arena of speaking truth to power. A very big welcome, Barb. I'm very much looking forward to hearing what you have to say.
Kia ora koutou. And I'm going to start with my view of a good mayor. They must firstly be able to bring the community along with them, being courageous, responsive, and a team player, and all that implies, is vital. By responsive, I don't mean bowing to pressure groups. I mean being truly consultative when seeking and receiving public feedback, being respectful of the huge knowledge bank of council staff and empowering them to use it. Valuing those things. The mayor has to be open to doing more than tweaking an old business as usual response. This takes courage and integrity. Secondly, they must have a sound grasp of the science behind climate change. They will need to understand their council's legal obligations through the Zero Carbon Act and the government's climate adaptation plan. I want to thank these six candidates. Their willingness to front throws into sharp relief the absence of Nick Smith and Tim Skinner. Now, some brief observations on the Tasman candidates. Mike Harvey suggests green technology will save us. He loves growth and doesn't seem to explain how that could fit with meeting emissions targets. Overall, he's short on detail and simplistic and not necessarily a team player. Richard Ormiston is aware of the threats and impacts of climate change. He observes we need to pull back on consumption. No argument there. An idealist without the pragmatism to carry his vision for any of his six councils. Ali Cook is conscious of her personal footprint. She struggles, however, to stay on topic and focuses on simplistic solutions. Tim King seems to have a good handle on issues. He says he is wary of quick fix solutions and talks about a range of concerns spanning green housing, the cost of not taking action, and product stewardship. However, when offered an opportunity to show leadership over cancelling the Targa Motor Rally, he disappointingly chose business as usual. See the Nelson Mail David Hansford article. On the 17th of September. Now, Nelson candidates. Matt Lawrie addresses the need to pitch initiatives positively in terms of multiple benefits and building a sense of community. He's pushing for a people-friendly inner city living culture. An awareness of inequity is inherent in his advocacy for free public transport and social housing. He's thinking holistically and is committed to a wholehearted climate response. His positive image of Mayor Matt on a Merrill e-bike in a smart, climate-friendly city could work. Rohan O'Neill Stevens shows an awareness of the science and the complexity of the issue. He promotes practical, adaptive measures and has an empathetic and inclusive view. He's aware of the need to invest early in climate resilience rather than to live with the cost of inaction. He's an expansive and quick thinker and an inspiring voice for the future. A very good reason why the voting age should be lowered so that those who will be most affected by climate change will get to exercise their vote in a next election. Kia ora.
Kia ora, Barb. Thank you so much for that. And again, another wonderful range of perspectives. This is being recorded the day after the main panel interview because I'm happy to say that Astrid Sayer has reported in that she's feeling miles better. So it's now a special pleasure to welcome Astrid to the show. Astrid is one of those articulate and engaged young people that makes an old dude like me feel very humble.
She's currently a student at Nayland College and is a member of the Nelson Tasman Climate Forum and also on the Nelson Youth Council. Tēnā koe, Astrid, I'm dying to hear your views of what you've heard on the podcast series. Over to you.
Kia ora, Lindsay, and kia ora koutou katoa. Nō tēne maka me Aotearoa ahau, ko Astrid say a tōku ingoa. Firstly, ngā mihi nui to Lindsay for his mahi with the series. It is so, so important for everyone to be informed when we place our votes, especially with such pressing issues this election. I'm 16 years old, meaning that I can't vote this election, but I still represent a large group of people with deep worry about the future of the planet. This is heightened by the fact that voting papers are not in our hands and that decisions often feel out of our influence. Therefore, I'd like to thank Lindsay again for inviting me to have my say, and I want to urge other people to think of young people and to listen to what the young people around you have to say. Seek and ask for our input, as we are the inheritors of the planet. I was disappointed that no candidates talked specifically about our responsibility as a bicultural country founded by Te Tiriti o Waitangi. Tauranga Māori and Indigenous knowledge is crucial to our climate response and to understanding our environment and for finding solutions. This is especially important because Māori communities will be adversely affected by climate change. This particular point was picked up on by Rohana Neil Stevens in the Just Transition question. Next, here are my responses to candidates' answers to how they would use their climate action magic wand in order of the candidates who spoke, beginning with Matt Laurie. I really valued Matt's kōrero about embracing active transport in a whole new way, as he puts it. Matt struck me as a visionary in this interview. Listening made me feel hopeful, and the way he sold his magic wand idea of an active transport revolution showed me he has a very good understanding of the issue. Matt also discussed the necessity of positive action and how scaring people is not the way to go. I really appreciate this with my understanding of climate anxiety amongst young people. Rohan O'Neill Stevens evoked similar feelings for me. I live close to the Maitai and I loved how he spoke of the river as something to be invested in. He gave me a wonderfully holistic answer where he talked about the Maitai becoming a shared social space to support recreation, transport and economic opportunities. I think Rohan gave a fantastic response centred around the Maitai River, and he has proved that he has great ideas and vision. With Rohan being relatively young, I think he gives a unique perspective and one that I would say represents many young people. Next to Richard Osmonton. I appreciate Richard's passion for his cause, but unfortunately, throughout listening to his section, I really struggled to hear what climate action he thinks should be taken now and what he could do as mayor to support climate action. Sadly, I couldn't pick much out of his response. After listening to the three candidates for Nelson, I definitely give my support to Matt Laurie and Rohan O'Neill Stevens. They will both lead us in the right direction. Next to Tim King, standing in the Tasman district. I noticed how he talked about wanting to have conversations with people with radically different views and to compromise to bring the majority of the community along with him. I admire his sentiment, however, his talk about compromising did concern me. When it comes to climate action, we need to do what is best for people and for our environment without compromise. He also talked about the difficulty of changing attitudes, which I agree can be a struggle, but also should be addressed and become a big part of our action if it's going to work. Next to Ellie Cook. Her kōrero about how she would wave her wand to make people take climate change seriously is something I know resonates with a lot of young people. For her interview in general, I also found it difficult to see what action she would take as mayor. Finally, to Mike Harvey. I really appreciated Mike's passion to find solutions and to learning, but I think unfortunately he showed that he wasn't particularly knowledgeable about climate issues. For mayor, we need someone who has clear visions and actions. After listening to all four of the Tasman District mayoral candidates, if I was to vote, I would put my reserve support behind Tim King. Thank you again, Lindsay, for the opportunity to share my reactions.
Kia ora, Astrid. Lovely to get your insights and your informed comments on the candidates' responses. Now it's time for us to change gear and move into discussion mode. So the panel's going to have a chance to pick up on issues that they've heard other people mention or that they've is burning a hole in their own brain that we haven't had a chance to cover. But in the first place, I'd just like to kick that off. Bob's last comment referred to the voting age, and I just want to throw out that unfortunately we haven't got Astrid with us in this discussion, which is our loss. But I would share that when I was talking with Astrid ahead of this panel discussion, She said how strange it felt to be listening to the online debate of candidates and know that even though she was engaging with it mentally, she was disempowered from voting. And that is a classic case, I think, of someone who is outside the current voting or below the current voting age and yet is acutely tuned into the issues we need to consider. So I'd like to throw it out to you, if what you take on board in terms of the voting age. And Peter, would you like to share a comment with us on that?
Yes, I completely agree that the voting age should be lowered to 16 at least, maybe more, maybe 15. But also it should be kept, because at the moment too much of the influence from voting is from older retired people who won't have to deal with the consequences long term of what they're proposing or not or blocking. I think both lowering of the minimum but also having a cap, and I'd suggest 16 to 66.
That's an angle that I hadn't heard, Peter, so I'm sure we're going to have a good chat about that. Yachal, please chip in there.
No, I think that's quite interesting, Peter. It reminds me of something that Dr. Olivia Hyatt mentioned, just in the sense that we don't have the social license often that we need for the massive social and economic transformations that we're going through. And I wonder if it's a lack of the license or a dilution of the license.
Yeah, that's interesting. The social license is an interesting concept. Barb and Jack, you both wanted to talk on this voting age thing. Barb, I'll go to you first.
Probably significant, because both Jack and I would have our votes taken from us because Peter's new initiative. And I would comment that in my experience, there are a lot of people who of our age who are advocating seriously for change for future generations. So I think rather than adding another barrier, we perhaps just allow youth, and therefore Astrid's very switched on colleagues and that demographic, to certainly have a say. I don't think it helps to add another barrier at another level.
Oh, interesting. Oh, we're into a good discussion already. Jack, you wanted to...
I would agree with that, but I think there's another point here, and I certainly would agree to lower the voting age. But I think we also need to appreciate the limitations of the whole voting system. You know, we sort of dither and nitpick with aspects of it, you know, such as the voting age. It's important, but the bigger picture is that the whole voting system doesn't work well.
Well, as you know, Astrid was able to join me the next day, and so I had the chance to put to her what the others had said about the voting age, and here's what she had to add to that discussion.
Yeah, thank you, Lindsay. Yes, as you mentioned, it feels very strange to be a young person who's rather interested and engaged in politics, and I'd say the same for many of my peers, yet, you know, you feel without those voting papers in your hand, it feels like it's someone else's decision. And that feels very strange, because of course we are just as much affected by the decisions that the government makes, and as I said, the inheritors of whatever effects those decisions have as well. And I think the other thing about lowering the voting age is many of these issues, particularly climate change, that are going to be affecting us in the future, if we have young people voting, that will also be a very key motivator for the government to address those issues, because those are issues that young people are very worried about. So, yeah, I think it's a strange and it's a scary thing, election time for young people, and I really urge people to think about that. I think the thing about the age cap at the other end, at 66, since I'm advocating for more people to be able to vote, I don't feel particularly comfortable about saying I support an age cap like that, but I appreciate the sort of the effort, I guess, to have young people's votes be made more significant. But I can't say I think that would be a step I'd want to take.
And I want to come back to the idea of the citizens' assembly, because that's a process that can take a very difficult and emotive issue, ensure that proper information, full kinds of disclosure and information is provided to all participants, and they are encouraged by a trained facilitator to work together to develop a consensus. And to me, that's a much stronger system for working through complex, difficult issues, rather than, you know, voting for this person or that person, and, you know, then you can then make submissions to various proposals, but it's a very limited involvement in the process, whereas more kinds of deliberative democracy would enhance public participation of people of all ages.
Mm-hmm. We can all chip in there, Yechiel. Please go for it.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point to raise, Jack. It's certainly been a theme in the podcast series participants that we heard from, was an enthusiasm for processes like this. I just wondered, am I correct in understanding that the participation in citizens' assemblies can often be randomised as well, which provides, you know, can provide a far more even playing field for thoughts and vision?
I think there is a core principle that it must be representative across the demographic of the community, isn't there? And yeah. Exactly how that's achieved.
One of the most important aspects of it is that it does away with special interest groups.
Mm. And also it must be funded so that they can bring in experts, that the people investing time in it aren't just volunteers in the process. I just want to get Peter's view in a moment, but I just want to pick up on one thing you said when you were discussing the mayoral candidates, Jack, and you mentioned that none of them went into the space of citizens' assemblies and so on. But I'd like to give Tim King a tick, because when he played his magic wand, his main wish was to formulate a way of having a bigger community discussion. And I think that was very much in that direction. But anyway, I want to hear what Peter has to say on this.
Yeah, I'll just make the point that I think citizens' assemblies are great, but again, we need to address the age that we're having participants in. So obviously we need young people in there too, and somehow we need to stop older people having an inordinate influence into proceedings. Yeah, perhaps I'm being antagonistic about saying, you know, it should be a cap at 66, but it's just somehow we've got to stop this shouty Joe, shouty Bob, you know, shouting down younger people who just want change, you know, and they're saying, no, look, it's always been done this way, this is the way it should be done. You know, I'm just worried about that. Well, the point needs to be made that our generation stuffed this up.
Yeah, totally.
You know, so what right have we got to say, oh, you should listen to us? I'm sorry, we've created this mess, you know.
Think that's a huge argument when we're talking about what mayoral candidate, should it be a Rohan or should it be a Nick Smith sort of thing? We actually got to make sure we don't perpetuate business as usual, don't we? Jack.
But I also was struck by the fact that there was almost no mention of agriculture in the discussion from any of the candidates. You know, we live in an agricultural community. Well, there was no, I mean, agricultural emissions are significant, and so are tourism emissions, you know, are both quite significant, and yet there was no mention of them.
Well, yes, I think our expectation would have been that if anyone was going to address farming and intensification and so on, it would have been Tim King, and I didn't see that was a priority for him to address. And as I've indicated in my summary, he seems to say and understand a lot about climate science, but doesn't necessarily seem really committed to addressing it. And this comes down to some of your comments, Jack, on what is strategic to present to a voting public. But Tim King did mention the FTS and say, oh, well, we've got to live with 50% greenfield development. So I guess one would not expect him to heavily talk about other aspects that are going to regenerate land, because he seemed prepared to accept that. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, interesting. A little bit of a common theme. Peter, you wanted to go on to a new topic, I think.
Yes, some of the candidates, and I guess reflected the general population, their knowledge of what is actually important to reduce climate change. It was appalling that Mike was thinking that stopping plastic running into the ocean was somehow going to solve climate change. You know, sure, there's issues with plastic in the oceans, you know, no doubt, but it completely misses the big things. And I think that sort of speaks quite a bit of to what a lot of people think, that, oh, look, I'm composting, I'm recycling my plastics, I'm doing good for the climate, yet they flit over to Bali for a quick break, or they, you know, go to Europe every other year, you know, mm-hmm. with massive carbon footprints that involves, or they're driving a fossil fuel car daily, mm-hmm. you know. Yeah, it's somehow we need to get this message across about what actually matters.
Mm. Yeah. In a way, Susan Crumdyke put it, didn't she? She said, the issue is to reduce using fossil fuels. That was almost her bottom line. Jack, you had something you wanted to chip in there, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to look at the other aspect of dealing with climate. That's adaptation. There was very little discussion of how, as a region, we are going to or are adapting to the impacts. I mean, we've already had floods, fires, you know, landslips, pestilence. I mean, the apocalypse is upon us, you know, and there seems to be little appreciation in all of the candidates that preparing for these inevitable disruptions, in fact, are going to also reduce emissions. That is, good adaptation involves emissions reductions. If you're growing food locally, for example, and you're eating a plant-based diet because you can grow it yourself, or you're growing it with your neighbors, then that leads to reductions in emissions as well. If you're arranging your life so that you don't have to travel so much to make a living, then you're going to be reducing your emissions, as well as becoming more resilient, you know. So mm-hmm. there's a whole range of things around adaptation that, to me, means building community resilience in food and energy. And Tim King did speak when he with respect to the energy issue that you posed to him, Lindsay, that we should be generating our own energy locally. And I think that's an important issue, especially given the vulnerability we have with the Alpine Fault rupturing, which is, you know, it's supposed to be imminent. So I think looking at the mitigation value of adaptation, as well as its resilience value, has merit. And I was disappointed that none of the candidates addressed that at all.
Jack, in that little comment, you referred to cohesive societies or community resilience. And Bob, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit and ask if you'd like to pick up at all on the question of community resilience or building it as a form of adaptation, because there's quite a lot of talk about physical adaptation, but the social and human side of it is so important.
Yeah, and I think there is it's easy to get a bit demoralised, as we all know, and it's very necessary, as Yakal referred to, the climate calm term, which I like. Mm. And I think that there are a lot of initiatives in the food growing communities that can induce positivity and awareness of, perhaps Yakal also said something about just not doing something, but it's also countering that with doing something. So I'm not eating meat. I'm, for example, I'm growing vegetables and the social engagement that comes on from that. People planting gardens out in the front, their street front, suddenly they're engaging with neighbours who think that's a good idea. And before long, it sounds simplistic, but we see that. We see the joy and the enthusiasm and the sense of community and spread that out in Nelson to the Waimarama Gardens and Tim's Compost Club. And suddenly you've got a real sense of positivity and achievement, and it's there conversations happen that relate to the climate situation and what else can we do. And I actually think that's really important, and I do think that Matt and Rohan both touched on the need for that kind of engagement, which of course can be expedited when you've got people on bicycles moving through the areas, being able to stop and talk to each other without a vehicle barrier between them and so on. So I think that is actually fundamental, and I think we have to be so careful to keep that empowerment at a very individual level with that kind of community activity in the garden. And that, yes, the yes, if, which you also mentioned, Yakao. I think it can be contagious in a really positive way.
Great, thank you. As you were saying that last bit, I was reminded of what James Renwick said when, during COVID, he said, and he was walking and biking and saw all sorts of things in his own neighbourhood that he'd always just driven past before. So that's pretty well what you're saying there, isn't it?
I really appreciate what you were alluding to, Barbara. In a sense, I think resilience is altogether or not at all. I've had a few colleagues who have described the individualist route as a bunker mentality, effectively. I think one of our contributors to the series talked about a community of relationships. I appreciated that term. You know, that is the elasticity that holds us through some of these difficult situations.
That was Mariana Stevens, I think.
Yeah, thank you, Lindsay. And so it's nice to see a level of understanding of that in our candidates, and yet in the same breath, there's a seeming acceptance of greenfields development and urban sprawl. And to me, one of the biggest risks inherent in that physical development is the barriers that it poses to community and cultural development. Yeah. If we don't live on those relatively dense streets, if we live in fenced property, if we don't have those interactions and the cause for it, then we cannot develop these other aspects.
Great, good point. Thanks, Yakao.
Can I add something more to the food thing? That again, it's not necessarily what we expect. That transport emissions in food is actually the least important thing, according to the John O'Drew study at Auckland at Dunedin University. I can forward that onto you, Jack, if you like, but the transport emissions are almost insignificant compared with what you eat. That's by far the most important thing. And as Monbiot, I'm not sure if many people heard Monbiot being interviewed by Kim Hill the other morning, he makes the point that when we stop eating meat, 3/4 of the land is suddenly available for carbon gobbling trees. You know, that's the other side of it. It's not just the sudden methane reduction that we don't have methane from the ruminant animals. It's also the 3/4 of the land that we don't need to grow food because we're not growing it through an animal's gut. We're eating plants directly. And that's completely missed by so many people.
Jack, would you like to pick up on that a bit?
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, you know, there's emissions from a variety of sources, and all of them need to be addressed because the magnitude of the problem that we have is so enormous. It's not a question of, you know, all of the above, unfortunately, is what we have to do. I just wanted to come back to this issue of the difficulties within our current political system of addressing these sort of complex issues. And of course, as many of us know, it's not just climate that is an existential risk. We have biodiversity loss. We have pollution of our air, water, soil. You know, we're simply using too much of nature for human purposes and not leaving enough for the rest of nature. So reducing a lot of these activities are critically important, beyond simple climate, even though climate is obviously a big and a very serious existential risk. But I guess I wanted to come back to the issue of people's involvement and participation and having a voice, and reminding all listeners to the series of the Nelson-Tasman Climate Forum as an opportunity to make use of your energies and your resources and your talents to work with other people in the community, make those connections.
Thanks for that, Jack. If I could just expand on that slightly, and that is, the word forum sometimes conjures up the idea of a talk fest, doesn't it? But in fact, the Nelson-Tasman Climate Forum is a very wide organization with working groups and media events. And
yeah, just one thing. I don't know if anybody saw the Nelson Mail today front page. A photo that I actually took, but other people could have.
Oh, yes, I did. You know, yeah, well done. Of
the water supply line being broken by a new slip from Clearfeld Forest directly above the water supply line, and how this is something we just got to stop doing. You know, clear felling forests on steep land, particularly above valuable infrastructure.
Particularly on a council forest as well, if I remember right. Yeah, it was a good article. Well done, Peter, to promote that. How we can support our elected representatives to make and implement the tough decisions. And so I'd be very interested if any of you had comment on how we get in our heads about voting for the people that are going to do what we need to do, because this stuff is coming at us. How we support them. It's not just a tick in a box at voting day, is it? It's a matter of empowering and supporting them and encouraging them to make the hard calls.
Just very briefly, people expect leaders to lead, but most of the time they don't actually lead. They sort of follow what the public are wanting at the time. Some people say that. I'm not sure if it's really right, but I don't know whether we can expect the leaders to lead without us making the grassroots changes first.
Could leadership not be giving a citizens' assembly a go? In other words, it may be them not making the decision, but they may be leading into another process or something. Would that fit?
That's an interesting sidestep, yeah.
Thank you, Lindsay. I think for that particular spectrum, the biggest thing for me is someone who can lead by example and can be out there in the community listening to people and championing things like diversity and equity and really listening to people and showing what they believe in practically, rather than being the person with their sort of face at the top, you know, being that big face at the top. And I think that's what really stands out about leaders, if they can do that, if they can lead by example.
One of the things that occurred to me about Citizens Assembly, if I were a politician, having to weigh various interests within the community, I would welcome the opportunity for a Citizens Assembly, which, if it's randomly selected and representative of the community, including youth and any other group that typically doesn't have a voice, and they reach a high level of consensus, which often occurs with Citizens Assembly, that would give me as a politician a lot of confidence that a policy or program emanating from that kind of consensus would have broad support. The only thing wrong with that is that it doesn't allow special interest groups to exercise their interest. Who we choose as candidates are clearly important, but to reinforce, I think the point that Peter just made is that unless the community can come together and provide a critical mass to present to the politicians and showing that there is broad consensus within the community.
Isn't one of the common outcomes of a citizens' assembly process one where different parties gain more respect for the other's views? There is a more cohesive outcome rather than people sitting and digging their own trench deeper and lobbing bigger rocks across at the other people. They are basically learning more understanding of where they're all coming from.
And, you know, I learned a long time ago from being involved in peace and conflict projects that the only true security is common security.
Great.
And this is true for climate and you know, existential ecological risk as it is for violent conflict.
Thanks for that, Jack. Bob.
Yeah, several things coming up here. I do know that councils globally have tried on a limited scale to use citizens' assemblies to resolve particular issues. And I think that's brilliant. But given the in-depth research I'm doing on particular candidates who are standing in this question, if candidates tell the truth, they make themselves unelectable, and the kind of stuff that is coming up with behind the stories that candidates are putting out there for them is totally alarming and scary. And the prospect, I'm thinking about some of these candidates who I've been looking at, imagining them sitting around the council table and looking even at the prospect of them saying, okay, let's try a citizens' assembly approach for this next issue, bring in some experts and actually try it. I'm kind of thinking that's a huge leap too far for the potential council I'm thinking in Nelson terms at the moment, but I think it transmits validly to Tasman as well, that it's a huge leap. Yes, it totally makes sense. And how can we support this to happen?
How would it look to take a yes if approach to that thought?
Ask the candidates if they can do that, absolutely. I just think that we need to really highlight with everyone that we engage with in any facet of the community at the moment that they need to be very aware of how the voting system works, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there and we could end up with people that are not really going to be pushing a climate agenda in any way and who are firmly entrenched in business as usual. So that research needs to be done and understanding has to be there of what STV means and what might happen to your vote if you don't do some research or consult with people who you know are doing the research.
Bearing in mind that STV is in Nelson, but not in Tasman.
True.
Just sort of adding to that, Barb, Lindsay, what you said, I think, about STV is crucial, that you only vote for the people you really want in there, and you don't vote for anybody you're not absolutely keen on having in there. And so it's better to vote for few people, just a very few people.
That's really valuable. I just wanted to clarify for anyone listening that STV was single transferable vote system.
Thanks, Yachal. It's time for me to thank you all very much for a wonderful contribution. And I really appreciate both the homework you've done and bringing your expertise and sharing your thoughts like this. So a very big thanks to you for being part of this series and a most important part in bringing a number of different viewpoints.
Well, isn't it great to hear a range of informed opinions and people who've carefully followed the series giving their take on what they think of the different mayoral candidates and some of the key points of our various guests over the last several weeks. Now, I always give you listening options for the series, and you can listen to the full interviews and the full podcast, that is the more formal take of each guest plus the discussion we had afterwards. You can listen to that, and these are available on Spotify and Apple and other main platforms and can be linked from my firm's website, which is at resilience.co.nz. And also that will give the full schedule plus background information, as well as links to Fresh FM's broadcasting frequencies and to the podcasts of the radio shows, where mostly they are condensed to about half the length of the full podcasts.
As always, a very big shout out to Kahu Sanson-Burnett. And Kahu's been invaluable both in terms of tweaking the sound for me as a sound tech and also to getting sorted and uploaded onto the podcast platforms. And he's been a huge help over a long time. So Kahu, this is a special thank you to you. And also, of course, a big shout out to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining us on what we feel is a very important discussion at a very important time. And so this is really Lindsay Woods signing out and saying, look, it's been such a privilege for me to engage with so many specialists, to have so many people supporting the series, and of course to have people listening as well. So as always, kia kaha for the climate, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.